They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:14 Wednesday, March 16th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. Honestly surprised to see Bill Finley here. Surprised considering the news that the baseball lockout is over. I thought you'd just be running around streaking all week.
Well, you won't see me the next 4 or 5 weeks as I'll be up at Fenway Park. Definitely that. Joe, good morning. This is Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. Last night, someone talked me into watching the finale of The Bachelor. 2 hours of my life. I'll never get back. Ooh.
Did you find love? Did they actually?
I guess so. Whatever.
Yeah. Sure.
I'm sure the sponsors found a lot of love. That was the most important thing. Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And I know baseball is important and The Bachelor is certainly important. But guys, can we talk a little bit about the NCAA tournament and how it's right on? We already had like the play-in round already, and now the big dance is going to start. But most importantly, my Richmond Spiders, my little Richmond Spiders, went into the A-10 conference sixth seed and knocked off like three of the top seeds and earned a bid to play Iowa on St. Patrick's Day. So go Spiders.
Congratulations. Good luck to your itsy bitsy Spiders in the tournament. Looking forward to that.
Right. You know that we named a horse years ago Richmond Spider?
No.
And to this day it has as many wins as I do. But the thought was there.
We'll get there.
Hopefully writers from the Philly will have a better career.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. A reminder that the Keeneland April Horses of Racing Age sale is Friday, April 29th, after that day's races. That'll be closing day of the spring meet. Spring meet opens April 8th, which is just 3 weeks away from Friday, so we're obviously looking forward to that. Entries for the April Horses of Racing Age sale are open right now. So we had a little bit of a mild weekend on the racing front. Tampa had a very nice card. Classic Causeway was the star in the Tampa Bay Derby. Once again, it'll be interesting to see what he does. I assume he's going to go straight to do the helium thing and go straight to the Derby. I can't imagine him running.
No, Joe, they said they're going to the
Bull. Oh, really? Okay. Thanks, yeah. Bill. Yeah, I was. And that seems like a lot. These days, that's a lot for a 3-year-old to play before the Derby. But that's interesting. So he was the star. There were a couple other nice performances. It's getting a little quiet on the Derby trail for the next couple of weeks. We got nothing going on now. Next Saturday, we've got the Fairgrounds, the Louisiana Derby card, as well as the UAE Derby. But I thought Classic Causeway looked good, not as good as in the Sam Davis. What did you guys think?
Yeah, Joe, he's an interesting horse. He definitely looked good, but you know, if you want to, you can nitpick a little bit here, starting with the buyer number. He got an 84 in the Tampa Bay Derby, which is slower than a Sam F. Davis, not by a lot. He went from an 88 to an 84, but an 84 is not going to win the Kentucky Derby. It's not even going to come close. Now, I'm not ready to say this horse isn't good enough or fast enough to win the Derby. I think, you know, he's kind of going out there and doing what he has to do to beat inferior competition. And, you know, I think he's probably another level there. And I'm, you know, glad to see that he's going into the Bluegrass because, first of all, I think that's the right thing to do by the horse. And it's an opportunity to win a huge grade one race. And that race will really find out how good he is, I think. And, you know, he's interesting, you know, really good horse, but is he maybe just a cut below the very best? That's what I would say right now. The other story out at Tampa on Saturday was with Aqueduct closed and Laurel closed for the weather. Hittled $20 million on the Tampa Bay Downs card. I mean, that is just like, those are Saratoga Gulfstream numbers. So congratulations to Tampa for putting on a great show last Saturday.
Yeah, and like you said, Joe, it's going to be thin news over the next couple of weeks with regard on the racing front, at least for these 3-year-old colts. Classic Causeway, I think, did enough to win. You know, he didn't really need to do anything other than break on top. And Irad did a nice job of controlling the pace at that point and just easing him, you know, quarter to quarter to quarter. And really was never in doubt, you know, once he broke on top. Again, you look at the card and you look at that group and you say, how many of these horses are going to be making any kind of noise in the upcoming preps other than Classic Causeway? And I'd be hard pressed to find anybody in that race that I feel is really going to make an impact over the next couple of prep races. But he did what he needed to do. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, when you have a football team and you say, oh, well, all they did was beat up on the also-rans. Well, that's the way the schedule laid out. And that's actually, you know, great management, you know, by Brian Lynch and the owners of Classic Causeway. You put them in the path of least resistance where you can get the most points and you earn the most money. And you continue to move on down the line. And, you know, if he did decide not to run in another prep race, you can make a case for it that he's done enough to run in the Derby. But Bill, to your point, his numbers aren't good enough right now. They're just not good enough. They're good enough to do what he's doing right now, but he's got to improve. And you'd like to think that a Giants Causeway is going to be a little bit later developing, and maybe he will have the potential to improve, you know, going forward. We've talked ad nauseum about how all these top 3-year-old prospects are all, you know, front running horses. So what's going to happen when he gets a buzzsaw and actually has to, you know, push faster than a 48 and a 113, you know, for 6'4" and 6 furlongs respectively? I don't know if he's got the constitution to be able to withstand that kind of a race, you know, run where there's a lot of speed favoring horses. Another race that I wanted to just talk about briefly is I thought CC ran very impressively in the Azari, you know, sitting off the pace and making a very patient run and really went by the rest of the field in that grade two, almost like they were standing still. And it was a solid group. There weren't a lot of horses in there. There were 7 horses in there. If you take a couple of claimers out there, you know, it was 5 or so horses that were in there. But CC, you know, did what she needed to do to beat Pauline's Pearl, and She Dares the Devil, who was the favorite in the race. And I was impressed that, you know, coming off a 4-week turnaround that she could win that grade two. And, you know, again, she looks like that she's continuing to blossom and doing really well as a 6-year-old.
Yeah, she's a really nice horse. And shout out to Michael McCarthy and Bo Hirsch for keeping her in training. She's probably going to end up in the Apple Blossom next. Clarier, actually, who's coming back later today at Fairgrounds, Steve Asmussen said that that's probably going to be a prep for the Apple Blossoms. That's always a very, very nice grade one for older fillies and mares this early in the season. As for Classic Causeway, you know, the pace was so much easier this time. And that's what I honestly expected him to really explode away in the stretch. And he didn't do that. And it was just he ran so much harder in the Sam Davis that maybe you think he might have regressed a little bit in this race, which is perhaps why he's trying to get another prep into him so he can get back into that top form by the time the Derby comes around. But yeah, it wasn't, you know, I want to pat myself on the back a little bit, but because Grantham ran second at 37-1. Remember what I was saying about those horses coming out of the Withers? I think a lot of them are going to run big at big prices going forward. But yeah, overall, that field, you know, once Classic Causeway broke like that and was able to get away with that kind of lonely lead, the race was over. And then you know, there was never anybody that was really going to try to challenge him like Paco did in the Sam Davis. So, you know, that kind of seemed like a foregone conclusion. I expected him to run away from those horses a little bit better than he did. He wasn't under super hard urging from Irad Ortiz. He just breaks so sharp that I think even if you kind of, even if you wanted to rate him, I don't know that you necessarily could because he's such a sharp gate horse. And I don't think he's fast enough to run with the Forbidden Kingdoms and the Epicenters. I just think he's, you know, he might be a cut below right now. And that's unfortunate for me because I have him in the contest. So we can throw up the slate right now. That was the only action, only change over the weekend in the contest. I got 50 points for Classic Causeway. So now I'm breathing down Bill's neck, only 10 points back. Bill's got 100. I got 90. Al's got 60. And then Sue, who has the leftovers. Don't forget, she's got the leftover team, Sue and John. Holding strong with 5 points so far, but still a lot of stuff, a lot of races to go. This was the last 50-point race of the Derby prep schedule. Going forward, they're going to be 100-point races for the winners. I agree with what John said about CeCe, but I thought the other really interesting horse from Saturday was Bleecker Street in the Grade Two Hillsborough at Tampa Bay. This is a horse who's 5-for-5 now for Chad Brown. You would think an undefeated Chad Brown horse would have had a little bit more name recognition by this point, but I got to be honest that I hadn't really heard of that horse before that race. And, you know, he ran great. He really kicked away in the stretch, really finished up fast, only got a 94 buyer, which I guess is nothing to write home about in a grade two, but, you know, just seems like an advancing, improving horse. Chad Brown also won the Florida Oaks with Dolce Zell, who was a shipper by Zell Zal, was a French stallion. Another big day for Irad Ortiz. He won the Columbia. He won the Florida Oaks. And he won the Tampa Bay Derby. So yeah, I, you know, a decent weekend of racing, but I just thought in even in Victory, Classic Causeway was a little bit disappointing. I don't feel as good about his Derby, you know, chances and prospects as I did going into that race, but still a lot of time, and it's, I'm glad we're going to be able to see him again before the Derby. And I just wanted to mention too, we had a couple of new rising stars over the weekend. One at Gulfstream, one at Oaklawn. On Saturday, it was a colt named We the People, who's owned by Windstar in partnership by Constitution. Another great name. I kind of feel like those Constitutions really lend themselves to having good names. Like John had one, you know, Amendment 19 was a really good one. And so I like We the People a lot. Ran in an allowance optional claimer at Oaklawn and really was kind of tossing his head about early on, but just ran away really powerfully in the stretch. New rising star. And also Green Up on Sunday at Gulfstream for Todd Fletcher was a Team Valor horse. Supposedly had been working up a storm, got hammered down to 2-5 and really just galloped home. So those two are very interesting. That's an upstart filly. Upstart's really starting to come along as a stallion as well. So I thought those two were interesting. And Rudy Brissett says that We the People is going to be on the Derby trail now. He says he's probably going to run him in the Bluegrass. He's only run a couple times, but, you know, why not? There's also one thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, we're going to talk about this with the Secret Oath news, but it just doesn't seem like there's any superstars yet on this three-year-old trail. You know, you want to say Messier? I could buy that. He may or may not be able to run in the Derby. Other than that, I think you have a lot of nice horses, but I don't think you have anybody that you have to be super, super scared of. Any thoughts on that, Bill or John?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, Joe. But, you know, right now we have to reserve judgment. Like you talked about Messier. We don't get the kind of information out of Baffert that we used to prior to all the Medina Spirit things. He doesn't, you know, he's careful about what he says to the media now. But I assume that horse will go in the San Diego Derby. And what if he runs off and wins by 10 again? You know, then you would have that kind of hype surrounded with what the heck is going to happen, whether or not this horse is going to be able to run in the Derby or not. And the same thing, I think, with Forbidden Kingdom. Those are the two that are the most exciting and have the most potential, I think. You know, and, you know, just like I said about Messier, what if Forbidden Kingdom goes out, wins the San Anita Derby, you know, by 6-7 lengths, just runs them off their feet again. So, yeah, you're right now. There are no horses at this point that, you know, look like they're going to be the obvious no-brainer favorite for the Derby. But I think there's a couple that could, you know, vault into that position between, you know, now and Derby Day, depending on what they do in the last series, perhaps.
I know when I was picking my horses for the contest, and granted, you know, I'm in last place, so you know, who the hell, you know, thinks that I did a good job. But that being said, like, there wasn't a standout. There wasn't a horse where with the number one pick, it was like, oh, okay, I'm definitely going to, you know, select fill in the blank as my horse and kind of ride off into the sunset and win this contest. And I think now that we're, what, 6 weeks past that point, you know, from when we did the draft, 4 weeks from when we did the draft, there's still not a standout. There's still, as a matter of fact, there's not, if I said to you, pick three horses out of the group that you think, you know, would be the favorite in the Derby, we'd still probably get it wrong. Because there's just not, they just haven't developed to that point yet. And granted, when we did the contest, I remember, you know, we talked about how like five out of the past 6 years, a horse, you know, the horse that won the Kentucky Derby was still an A other than at that point. Like it's still early, even though, you know, we're approaching these 100-point races and that, you know, the rubber is going to meet the road really, really soon. But for the most part, there's not that like awe-inspiring horse as a three-year-old colt. I will say, and we were talking about this before the show, like Echo Zulu is still the horse that, you know, the three-year-old at least, granted she's a filly, still a three-year-old that captures my attention and imagination. You know, are they going to run her, you know, in the Derby? Who knows? I mean, I don't know. That's a big stretch, especially because she hasn't even made her three-year-old debut yet. I know it's coming, but hasn't made it yet. But yeah, when you look up and down the top 12 or the top 20 horses, as Derby contenders, there's nothing that you know makes you gravitate and say that's the one. There's some exciting horses, but there's not like that one horse, like almost like with the NCAA tournament coming up. It's not like that hands down, you know, number one. Let's pick Duke in the 90s or UNLV, you know, before that. There's no real dominant horse where you go, that's the one that excited me and captured my attention. you know, for this Derby drill. But we have a lot of races to go and a lot of points that'll get shifted around. So I like where I'm sitting right now. You know, in last place, I'm like a closer. You guys are the front runners. I'm the closer, and I'm just going to bide my time and wait and wait and wait. And, you know, I'll be holding the trophy up like Terry Finley did in you know, with Always Dreaming. Just, you know.
John, the Richmond Spiders have a better chance of winning the NCAA tournament than you do winning this contest.
Oh, challenge accepted, Bill Finley. How dare you? How dare you? Oh, my goodness.
Just one more point. I think that's that what we're saying is confirmed by the future wager over the weekend, because, you know, first of all, the field was still favored, but the shortest price individual interest was Smile Happy, who didn't even win his first race as a 3-year-old. He only run once as a 3-year-old and he lost, but he's 6-1. He's the lowest price of any of the 23 individual interests in the Derby future wager. Obviously, that's affected by Messier and the whole Baffert situation, but I just think that speaks to how that's there isn't a clear leader right now. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. As I mentioned in the open, we're just a few weeks away from the Keeneland Spring Meet. Super looking forward to opening weekend. Starts April 8th. A Grade 1 Bluegrass headlines opening weekend. And this week, Brian Lynch, as we mentioned, said that Tampa Bay Derby winner Classic Causeway is probably pointing that way. So it should shape up as one of the most exciting Derby prep races of the year, as it usually is. A lot of big races at the Keeneland Spring Meet. We got the Ashland. We got the Commonwealth actually has come around and become a nice race for sprinters. We got the Madison, the Maker's Mark, the Jenny Wiley. You know, it's a big opening Saturday. John, what would you say? You know, you want to say the Bluegrass, but what would you say otherwise is your favorite race at the Keeneland Spring Meet? I feel like you're going to say the Ashland.
Yeah, the Ashland. I mean, just exactly. You're exactly right, because we won it so many years ago, and it's just always been near and dear to my heart. And it's funny because when we won it, we had no clue the importance of it. You know, we were just like, oh, this is great. You know, it's Keeneland. And it wasn't until later on where I really had such an appreciation for not only racing at Keeneland, but winning a race of that magnitude at Keeneland. And guys, I can remember this was like in 91 when we won it. So now it's ancient history. It's 30 years ago. But I remember walking out of Keeneland and we had the trophy in the car and we like seatbelt it into the back seat of the car. And we drove downtown and went to Dudley's for dinner. And we walked in, and when we walked in, and again, we're like, you know, it was me and my parents from New Jersey. Nobody really knew who we were. And we walked in and everyone in the restaurant gave us a standing ovation. And I was like, this is great. I love thoroughbred racing. What could be better than this? And like, we didn't pay for our meal. We didn't, you know, it was just a really cool feeling. But that's how much racing is intertwined with Lexington. That's how much Keeneland means to, you know, to the sport and to the industry and the region. When you win a race at Keeneland, irrespective of whether it's the Ashland or a claiming race, it's a big freaking deal. And it's like front page news in the sports section of the Lexington Herald. You know, and you're a celebrity for that, you know, for those few minutes. So, you know, racing at Keeneland has always been really special for me. We're going to bring horses to Keeneland again with Mark Cassidy. We're going to run Coinage in the Transylvania. We're going to run Glider in the Lexingtonian. So, you know, so we're going to be, you know, having a group of horses there. And I'm really excited that we're going to go as a collective group, you know, for the writers room and have our, you know, show, you know, there in that setting. Because I don't think that we can really describe to the audience, if you've never been to Keeneland for the race meet, it's just a magical place. You go back in time. It's like there's two racetracks where I say that, you know, Saratoga and Keeneland, where you just go and you're part of the community and everyone's so excited about racing and nobody's talking about the negatives of racing. Everyone's talking about the excitement and what's going on that day and people get dressed to the nines. It's just it's like Disney World for racetrackers. I can't describe it, you know, any better than that. It's a magical place.
You hear that, Keeneland and Lexington? John wants the red carpet treatment every time he wins a race there.
Demand it. We demand it, damn it. We're going down there with Joe Bianca, $600,000 underbidder.
That's right. Some respect on my name. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's Network.
He was just put together like a machine, and he had a great mind. Everything about him was what you'd want.
Tis the law, pops the cork in the champagne. Tis the law is gonna win the first leg of the Triple Crown.
I've never seen him get tired.
Respect the law, tis the law.
His structure is just perfect. His bone is perfect.
He's left the others behind. He's gonna win the run, Happy Travers.
He's everything you would look for in a horse.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Coolmore. After day one of the OBS March sale, which started yesterday, already been some high dollar sales for Ashford's three first crop sires. Mendelssohn had the highest priced filly of the first session. Half sister to Derby Hopeful Simplification brought $525,000 yesterday. Definitely got to keep an eye on those Mendies throughout this season. And then he had a colt go for $350,000. Also Motown, son of Uncle Mo, stands for just $7,500 this year, had a colt go for $260,000 to West Point Thoroughbreds and our boy Terry Finley, who we talked to yesterday. And Justify only had one go through the ring the first day, but the colt brought $250,000. He's got four more going through the ring later today at OBS. This kind of ties into our last segment about how there aren't really too many scary three-year-olds, at least at this point, on the Derby trail. So that, I think that was part of the reason, at least, that Dwayne Lucas and the connections of Secret Oath have chosen to go into the $1.25 million Arkansas Derby, which is April 2nd. She's going to take on the boys. I said before that I thought this was a good idea, especially in Arkansas. I think the Arkansas three-year-olds really have not shown you anything, you know, awesome so far. You know, in the past we had like horses like Nadal winning the Rebel, where, you know, kind of could scare off some horses. But Secret Oath is going to go in the Arkansas Derby. Doesn't sound like she's going to go in the Kentucky Derby right now. Judging from the quotes from Wayne Lucas, it looks like the Oaks is still on the schedule. I just wanted to read you some of the quotes from Dwayne Lucas. He said, "We don't make these decisions, meaning the owners and myself. We don't make them easily. We consider all of the things. First of all, you absolutely want to think that you are as good as any of the other three-year-olds that might show up. And you don't really know who's going to show up. Second, you got to consider that she's here at home. If you're going to step out of the box, that's probably a good spot to do it. She's been successful at this racetrack. The third thing is a $1.25 million purse is probably the most attractive purse she'll ever run for outside of the Breeders' Cup. So that tells you that they're probably not going to go in the Derby. And the owner said, Wayne and he talked about it before the Honey Bee. They wanted to see what her performance looked like in the Honey Bee and then see what the Rebel looked like and see how she did in her first workout after the Honey Bee. He said, we feel like we ought to give her a chance to run against the boys and see how that goes. That's kind of how we thought about it. And then Dwayne Lucas added that he's got the Oaks on the schedule. That's where he's going. They have no plan to run in the Derby now. He says that's not chiseled in stone either, but that's the way the Mitchells, who own her, feel. They don't want to run in a 20-horse field. They feel like the Oaks is every bit as prestigious. If she runs in the Arkansas Derby and wins off by like 8-10 lengths, I feel like it's going to be very hard to ward off the calls for her to run in the Kentucky Derby. But if you go and look at like the sheet numbers, the buyer figure, she doesn't stand out as much. But if you look at the sheet numbers, she's been running a 1.5 in her last two races. And just for comparison's sake, Classic Causeway, who was odds on in a 50-point race over the weekend, had only run fives in his previous race. So she's right up there, you know, figure-wise with these boys. And it's always good to see trainers step out of the box. What do you guys think?
Joe, first of all, she doesn't have to win the Arkansas Derby by 8 or 10 lengths. If she wins the Arkansas Derby, she's in the Kentucky Derby. I mean, Wayne, you're not fooling anybody here. Come on, pal. It would make no sense to go in the Arkansas, take this chance and run the Arkansas Derby and then take the step back to run in the Kentucky Oaks. So that I think is a no-brainer. I love this move. For one thing, it's nice to see an American horse trainer actually take a chance and do something a little bit outside the box, which we never, outside of Kenny McPeak, we never get anymore. And you're right, Joe. If Baffert were coming in with some killer who was going to be, you know, one is like a Messier or something like that, then it wouldn't be the best shot. But the Rebel stunk. I think John disagrees with me because I know we've talked about this a little bit off the air, but she'll be the favorite in the Arkansas Derby. So if you have a horse that's going to be the favorite in a $1.25 million race, why not go for it? I mean, I know the other one, the Fantasy's nothing to sneeze at $600,000, but the purse is double. And also, if you don't go in the Arkansas Derby, you have no chance of running in the Kentucky Derby because you get no points. John, you mentioned about Echo Zulu, and, you know, is she better than the boys? Well, we're not going to get a chance to find out because she's going to run one time in a traditional filly prep. We'll the Fairgrounds Oaks will have no points for the Kentucky Derby. So they're in a position where they can't make that decision. I love it. Good old D. Wayne. You know, it's nice to see him in there mixing things up.
And D. Wayne has a history of doing this. Let's not forget that, you know, he ran and won the 88 Derby with Winning Colors. You know, so he's got a game plan and a way of doing this. And you know, to your point, Joe, about, hey, this isn't a scary group. I mean, nobody is going to confuse this group of 3-year-old colts that are currently running at Oaklawn with Charlton or Nadal or Omaha Beach or Classic Empire, American Pharoah. You know, that won a number of the races, the Arkansas Derbies of recent memory. You know, and Bill, I hear what you're saying as far as, hey, why not run her as the favorite in a $1 million race versus something that's going to be, you know, half the value as far as from a purse standpoint. And she runs against the boys and doesn't run well and then goes off and wins the Oaks and has a good 3-year-old filly year for herself. She still probably is going to be an Eclipse ballot horse, if not. If not a contender for the 3-year-old filly of the year. So, I mean, if she's going to run against the boys, this is the time to do it because the group is devoid of talent compared to her. It's the right distance. It's her home track. And D. Wayne has done this in the past. Do I think if it was my filly, we would be doing this? No, we wouldn't. We'd be doing the path of least resistance and getting her to win because as a broodmare candidate, you know, whether she won the Rebel or the Arkansas Derby or the Honeybee or the Fantasy, you know, it's all in breeders' minds. It's all similar kind of races. Yeah, there's a little bit more cachet for beating the boys. But if people really dig in and look to see who she beat in that race, they may not be quite as enamored with it as if she had won, say, the Oaks, you know, where that's really more of a signature 3-year-old filly race. And it sounds to me like even though it's not going to be as robust of a group of horses as far as numbers, the Oaks may have, you know, pound for pound, the better group, especially if some of these fillies come in that are rounding into form, whether it's Echo Zulu or Nest or, you know, some of the other ones that we talked about last week. The filly group, in my estimation, is stronger than the colts at this point.
I don't know about all that. I mean, it's maybe at the top, but I feel like it's deeper. The 3-year-old colt division is deeper right now. But like you said, there's still some time. I'm interested to see when Echo Zulu comes back, how she's going to run because, you know, it's possible that she'll end up being scarier than anybody in the Derby field, you know, and then that might affect the decision of Dwayne Lucas and the Mitchells for Secret Oath. But I'm so happy to see it. You know, I just feel like I think that sometimes people get a little bit too obsessed with running the fillies against the boys, but it just, there comes a point in a filly's career when she's beating up on all of her competition over and over and over again. I think of, like, you know, Zenyatta and Songbird, and you're dying for them to really take a chance and really challenge her. This, who knows, like, where she ranks in the 3-year-old fillies. Like, she's no lock to be champion 3-year-old filly. So this is taking a step out of the box early on and getting a real sense of where she stacks up with the 3-year-olds across the country. So, you know, I obviously applaud it, tip my cap to D. Wayne and the owners because we love to see it. And it's going to add a lot of juice, I think, to a race that we weren't going to normally be excited about. This Arkansas Derby, I don't think was going to be really a marquee race on the Derby Trail calendar like it usually is, but this is going to add a lot of excitement, a lot of cachet to that race, so we're looking forward to that. The TDN Riders Room is brought to you by Lane's End. This week's Lane's End Stallion of the Week is Accelerate. The champion will see his first 2-year-olds hit the track this year. He's already had a few go through the ring at OVS March, including a filly from the family of Grade 1 winner Roman Ruler. I always liked Roman Ruler. And El Corridor, who sold for $250,000 to West Point Thoroughbreds. West Point making waves again. And Tala Racing, as well as a colt, who's a half-brother to my boy, the multiple stakes winning New York bred Mr. Buff. He went for $200,000 to agent Mike Ryan. 5-time Grade 1 winner, Breeders' Cup Classic winner, stands at Lane's End this year for $15,000. We talked to John Sadler a couple weeks ago when we had him on to talk about Flightline. talked to him off the air about accelerating. He's heard a lot of good things about his two-year-olds, and I actually have heard the same stuff. I'm not as plugged in as the John Greens and the John Sadlers of the world, but I hear a lot of buzz about those horses as well. So definitely got to check them out at OBS March later today, and then later on in the spring at the Gulfstream sale in OBS April as well. Look out for those accelerates. We'll be right back after this message from Lane's End.
Accelerate, a five-time Grade 1 winner with over $6 million in earnings. In 2018 alone, he won the Santa Anita Handicap, the Gold Cup, the Pacific Classic by a record-setting 12.5 lengths, the Awesome Again, and bested a world-class field in the Breeders' Cup Classic. A grandson of legendary Lane's End stallion Smart Strike, Accelerate stands to continue his grandsire's legacy at Lane's End.
With some of the fullest fields in the country and quality racing year-round, there's never been a better time to reap the rewards of breeding and racing in Kentucky. Purse money in Kentucky is at an all-time high, as is average purse per race, outpacing California, Florida, and New York. Kentucky breds. Breed them. Raise them. Race them. We all win.
The TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by the Kentucky Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders. Kentucky Breds are dominating both in the sales ring and on the racetrack this year. Kentucky Breds have won 5 of the 6 Grade 1 races held in America so far in 2022. And 10 members of T.D. Thornton's most recent Derby Top 12 are Kentucky Breds. And on a global scale, last weekend, Lighthouse became the most recent Kentucky Bred Group 1 winner with a score in the Group 1 Coolmore Classic in Australia. Shout out to LNJ Foxwoods for taking a shot there, getting a big Group 1 win down under. And in the first session of the OBS March sale, 9 of the top 15 highest priced horses were bred in Kentucky. Speaking of OBS March, we talked to Terry Finley, the CEO of West Point Thoroughbreds, yesterday, a little bit before the OBS March session 1 started. Great interview with Terry. He's always a very insightful guy. Talked a lot about the sales, talked a little bit about Flightline, and just always good to talk to Terry. So check out our interview from yesterday, Terry Finley. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So back in the hot seat this week, I believe for the fourth time, one away from the five-timers jacket, is West Point CEO Terry Finley. Thanks for coming on, Terry.
Absolutely. Great to be with you guys. I think it was just about a year ago, right? You guys were set up in the back, and it was in the midst of the COVID situation. But I thought you guys, you did a great job coming down. I thought it showed a lot of the people that came to the March sale last year that, you know, we're starting to get this thing back to normal.
Totally. And that's, you actually led me in my first question perfectly, because I remember we were talking on the set last year about how the good vibes were starting to come back to Ocala. It felt like a little bit of a reunion for everybody down there. You're in Ocala now. The sale starts later today. What would you say the vibe is now compared to last year?
I think it's solid. I know everybody's reading the news and the terrible situation over in Europe and in Ukraine, I think is in the back of our minds. And the equity markets, especially over the last couple of weeks, in particular, the last 2 weeks, they've been turbulent. So I'm sure if I ran the sales company, I'd be thinking about those things. And but I think overall that there's an air of optimism, but there are some restraints on that optimism. I don't think it's overflowing. But if the first, 200 horses, if they're rocking and rolling, I think that optimism will surge in a big way, and the other way. So I think the first couple hundred horses will be, set the stage, so to speak, on the two-year-old sales for the rest of the year.
Yeah. And Terry, one of the exciting things about not only the fact that this is the first two-year-old sale, but there's a lot of good freshman sires that are being represented in the catalog. With Good Magic and Always Dreaming, who is near and dear to your heart, and Mendelssohn and Bolt Oro, and don't forget about Justify. When you guys look at a sale like this, are you keying in on the new sires? Give the audience an idea of what you're looking for with those new studs.
Yeah, so we were talking about that today, John, going over our short lists to get horses vetted. And one of the things that we were talking about, you know, there are some pedigrees here. I'm saying on the lower end of the sire list, right? That if we went to the yearling sales, we wouldn't even look at, right? Because there were pedigrees that I couldn't get our arms around. But I think the advantage for those kind of horses is they can come to the sale and they can train up to the sale and they can show well in the breed show. And the people who aren't just locked into the very top end pedigrees are like, all right, he's very viable or she's very viable. So I think that's a plus, you know, especially for the people who buy horses, you know, I've seen horses for $2,000 or $3,000 in this sale, and I've seen others for $450,000 as a yearling price. So, you know, it spans the spectrum, which I think is great for buyers. But there are some really, really good sire. I'll give you one. Collected is one that I'm hearing a lot of good things about. And Bolt de Oro is another one. And, you know, all those others, right, they're getting some talk. But I think those two are the ones that people are somewhat intrigued by. But, you know, it's all about the individual. You know, we know that we've been in the game a long time, you know, all of us. And I think that's what separates, you know, when you can stand in front of them and you can see their physical and look at their stride lengths and all that other data. But I agree. This is a very exciting young group of sires that are in the market, and, you know, they're trying to make a name for themselves, and they're trying to stamp themselves as a sire that, you know, that have or that could have a real nice future.
You know, I always think of the sales kind of as the NFL draft process. I feel like the breed show is like combine day. You kind of all you have your feelings about these horses on the paper, on pedigree, from talking to consigners, from hanging around the barns, and then the breeze is the combine day. You see, they run the 40-yard dash. It might be a 4 or 5. You thought it was going to be a 4 or 4. So I kind of wonder about that and how, you know, how much the breeze impacts your preconceived notions about the horses. Like, what is the balance in terms of pedigree, in terms of all the other information you have, and then the actual breeze itself?
Yeah, I tell you, Joe, I think that's really one of the cool parts of a 2-year-old sale anywhere is the fact that you have a lot of different inputs. You know, there are some consigners that you would see a 10-1 and knowing their history and the way they bring these horses to the market, you know, a 10-1 might be very, very good. And so you look at that in your calculus, right? Then you see somebody else and you see a bevy of 9-4s and they have a horse work a 10-2, and you're like, you know, in that program, this is a factor. But you're also thinking about the fact that if, you know, to see a well done a 10-2, you know, is a lot better than a really pressed and like a scrambling 9-4. And, you know, you talk about the way they come away from the pole. There are some of them don't come away from the eighth pole as quickly as they probably could have. And therefore, 10-2, you know, on top of a good gallop out is going to pick our heads up. So, you know, there's so many things that come into play. And I think one of the things, and I know the vast majority of the big buyers have teams, but I think it's key to have somebody at the shoot, and they're able to take notes, and they're able to see, and they're able to hear them as they gallop out, and they see if they're being pressed in the gallop out. You know, some people say, you know, this horse galloped out in 33 and change, you know, but the people that are at the shoot are seeing that the kid is still whipping and driving into the turn and down the backside. So I don't know. I just think that art and the science, when you put all those together, I just think it's a fascinating situation for all of us trying to pick out the really good ones out of the 600 that are going to go through the sale.
Yeah. And Terry, you mentioned a couple of key components, and that is, you know, the gallop out and how important that is, and also whether or not these horses are making noises as they're breezing and as they're galloping out. Give the audience an idea of, like, when you look at it, when you look at the whole calculus, to use your term, and you're deciding between looking at horses, what's the most important thing? Is it the gallop out? Is it the notes? Is it the sire line? Like, you know, give us the secret sauce. What is Terry Finley looking at first and foremost when making his decision?
Well, John, I think first and foremost, there is no secret sauce. And we bring that up to prospective partners all the time. And I think that's a selling point, to just acknowledge up front, you know, the obvious to all of us that have been in the game. There is no secret sauce I know a lot of us spend a lot of time and a lot of money studying this game. And I'd like to think, you know, we're all pretty smart or better. And I'd like to think that we would have identified that secret sauce. So, you know, it just depends, right? There's a small segment of the group of horses that are going to be sold in the next couple of days that on the surface are obvious. You know, they put everything together, they pass the vet, they work really, really well. So those you don't have to really think a whole lot about. But, you know, when you think about the bell curve, the vast majority of them are in the middle. And so I think then you take a look at, you know, the comments from the consigner and the fact that, you know, you've done work with the consigner and you trust the consigner, I think is very helpful. And the way they've come out of the breezes and the way they're acting, obviously they've got a lot of stress on them. They breezed, at the end of last week or on a Saturday. So I don't know. I think all those things. So I do know that you don't apply the same protocol for every horse, because every horse comes at you in a different way and in a different fashion. So that's the way I would answer that question. It's a beautiful game when you are thinking that, you know, you have things and you're starting to get your process straight, but you always got to continue to improve your process. And I think we all look at people who are very successful in this game. And I think the one takeaway that I see time and time again is they always are trying to get better. And I'd like to think that we are as well.
I mean, that's the thing about this game. You know, it's a lot of thrills, but it also kick you in the ass and humble you too. And I think that's part of what keeps you coming back also. But we talked a little bit off the air about this, about some of the new medication rules at the sales. And we've heard in the past about the banning of bisphosphonates, the banning of clenbuterol. But you were talking a little bit about NSAIDs. And can you explain what the new rules are and what the impact might be?
I sure can. So we think, you know, as a buying group, you know, the people I talk to think it's been a really good thing. Today, right, you can only use 3 NSAIDs. So that's one thing. And the other thing is you can't medicate any horse with anything, or you're not supposed to, up to 24 hours before the breeze. So I think as a whole, right, that's going to give us, as time moves on and we see the impact of the changes and the updating of the medication rules, I think we're going to see people who are going to be thinking about that. Like, I'd much rather work this horse 10-1 and to have them be sounder after the breeze than 9-4 and to be in a position where I can't treat them and he's really, you know, dinged up or you know, tucked up or, you know, any of the things that horses do when they come out of a fast breeze. So, you know, I think overall we are definitely headed in the right direction. And, you know, overall, I just think it's going to cause and it's going to put the real horsemen and the better horsemen in a better spot. And I think that's good for everybody when the true horsemanship, right, can come out in the product that those consigners and the sales companies are running through the ring and offering the market.
Yep. And Terry, you were around when you know, when I was looking at horses also early on at 2-year-old sales, you know, many, many years ago. And I remember the 10-second eighth of a mile was like the glass ceiling and nobody was going to go faster than that. And now we have a horse that actually went in 9-3. Do you think that you and I are going to see the day where we get a horse that runs in 9 seconds? And is that good for the industry?
Yeah. So I think it was probably, I do draw somewhat of a comparison with the 4 minute mile.
Right.
You know, everybody thought the 4 minute mile and, you know, back then when we were growing up early, you know, we'd go to the trotters and we'd see a 2 minute mile and that would be, you know, that would be really something when they broke 2 minutes. Right now, the world record in the standard bred business is what, 1:45. So, we're not going to see that kind of dramatic change in the times of the thoroughbreds. But look, I know that we can't dictate, right? The sales company can't dictate. The buyers can't dictate to the sellers to slow things down. I understand that would be great if we could. But the takeaway, though, is that I think the consigners more and more see the real players in the game at the top end of the game, right? We can see by and large, right? All of us have been doing it for a long time. So with a solid prospect, we can see that they've moved well over the racetrack and they've done all the things to put themselves in a position to be a possible good horse. And a stopwatch, we all know that, you know, a stopwatch is one part of the equation. And I don't know. I sense consigners are starting to get their arms around that. And I think that's a very, very good thing. And I applaud them. I really do. You know, it doesn't do anybody any good to have these horses and to have, you know, a percentage of these horses after a fast breeze, you know, to be on a negative path and to be, you know, there are plenty of horses that don't get to the races for any number of reasons. You know, I'd like to think that we all love horses. We all advocate that we love horses. And I think we're taking care of horses when we dial things back, knowing though that we can't dictate that.
I mean, like I was saying with the combine, like plenty of people have run fast 40 times and not become good NFL players because it's just a small sliver of what they're able to do.
You know, I think when you're in it, right, everybody's seeing that Tom Brady, that 40. I don't know, what did he run? He ran a 5.1 40 or something.
Yeah,
and he didn't look good doing it either. No. You know, that's the one thing you talk about, not how fast they go, it's the way they go fast.
Yep.
Well, and we're all looking for those horses. But man, it's just crazy when you think about the good horses that come out of the 2-year-old sales up and down the line. And you know, when you look at the stats, it's a tough deal when you pay a lot of money for a 2-year-old. There is some correlation, but I don't think it's a super strong correlation that you increase your odds by a big margin when you pay a lot of money. And we've done it. And, you know, I think we'll continue to do it. I don't think we'll continue to do it as much because I love the fact that the horsemen are coming forward and they're buying $25,000 yearlings and they'll take a good profit. And I think those kind of transactions, I think we're seeing more and more the horses that end up in the Fountain of Youth, you know, that colt that won the Fountain of Youth, he was, you know, not very expensive at this sale or at the April sale last year. So I don't know. It just, you know, you can look at data, you look at all the markers, you know, it just comes down to trying to land on as many good horses and good prospects as you possibly can. And it's a frustrating game, but we all love it. And we all love it. And it's because, right, we know that any Ibarra, Cott Campbell term, any of us can catch lightning in the jaw at any sale.
Right.
You know, we all love that. We all love that about our great game.
No, absolutely. And Terry, you mentioned before about, you know, good horsemen coming in and coming together and buying horses. And it seems like more and more that, you know, these top outfits are coming together and buying horses, whether it's Windstar in China, you know, club or the Avengers, or even, you know, we've even partnered up on some stake horses as well. Who do you bring down with you for this sale? You know, because I'm sure you're going to be taking a swing at one of the top colts.
Yeah, so. So David and Gordo and his team are really the advanced team for us. And, you know, we've worked together since 2017. This sale was the first time that we had started back then. And one of the things I've learned, I try to stay out of his way. Like, I acknowledge I'm more of a business person. I've been around the game for a long time, but I don't have hands-on experience at this level. And so, look, everybody wants to take the credit when things go well. Obviously, not so many people when things don't go well. But I found that really my job and I'd say focus is to let the pros, do their thing. And then come in at the towards the end of the process as we get closer to the sale. So I think we're starting to see the benefit of that, because one thing I know you can't do is you can't buy by committee. I think it's been proven. Although there's some good horses that have been bought by committee, but I think by and large, when you see the successful operations, you're seeing one or two people that are the decision makers. I think that's very important. I know in our case that we coalesce behind David and Gordo and his team. And I think that gives them more latitude. I think that gives them more confidence. And, we support them and we're there. And, our job is to find partners and to develop relationships with trainers and to run a business. But it really starts with buying good prospects.
One of the partnerships that you've had that's been really successful is the one on Flightline. And we talked about this on the show. I've said it's maybe the best bargain for $1 million you could ever have in buying a racehorse. Usually that's a big risk, but this looks like it's going to hit big. So everybody wants to know about him. He's honestly the most talked about horse that I can remember in years, like probably since Justify won the Triple Crown. So first of all, how's he doing? But also, like, how does it feel to have that kind of horse who's so good and so popular? I imagine this is why you get into the game to begin with.
Yes. I think anybody that buys horses and that plays the game, they wonder and they see those types of horses that justifies the American Pharaohs. You think back back when we were kids, all those good horses. I think you dream about what does it feel like? What does it feel like? It is a special feeling. I'm not sure quite whatever I expected. But I asked myself on a continuing basis, like, when is it going to be our time? When is our time? And then we got a couple indications when he was a 2-year-old that, he could be something special. So I think everybody's heard that story. And, now, we, as well as everybody else, we'd love to run them more. I think it's just one thing. The circumstances. He's not an unsound horse by any stretch. He just strained a hock, and that took him out of training for 3.5-4 weeks. But he's back to the racetrack, and he's just about ready to turn around and start galloping. And we'll be there in New York on Belmont Stakes Day for the Met Mile, and we can't wait. And we love for it to be as solid of a field as possible, because I think when he runs against those better horses, I think his, the aura like around him, and if he's successful, I think the aura will continue to grow. But we've got great partners on him. There's always everybody gets along. Everybody puts our support behind and in the hands of John Sadler. So I know John's happy with him, and it'll be a long wait between today and late in the day on Belmont Stakes Day. But we just hope that wait is worth it. But I will tell you, overall, to put a bow on it, it's an honor to be like associated, right? We know horses, they do so much for us. And when you get one like this, that's very, very special. And it could be one of the ones that they talk about like 100 years from now. Like, that's, that just puts a smile on your face.
Yep. No, that's exactly why we do this. And Terry, you've gone all in. I mean, you even moved, you and your family to Kentucky to be more involved in the industry. And subsequently, you're very, you have your fingerprints in what's going on in the industry, and you're a member of the Jockey Club. And tell us a little bit about what we can expect from the Jockey Club as far as continuing with safety protocols and making the industry better.
Yeah, John, certainly a proud member of the Jockey Club. I think they do a lot of good things. And one thing I say to people, because I'm at a sale, I see you and I see the players out in the industry. And, you know, people talk to me all the time and they complain about something. And I understand the Jockey Club is not perfect. But I know one thing, that their agenda, I think overall the size and the scope of their vision, Jim Gagliano at the helm, I think that size and scope is really good for our industry overall. And, their agenda is to just make our game better. And, you know, one thing I ask people is, what would our industry be like if we didn't have the Jockey Club and we had the desperate organizations and the horsemen's organizations and everybody? You know, it's a tough game in that respect, because we all compete against each other. We're all smart people, but we don't all look at the exact same situation in exactly the same way. So I think, especially in a time like this, where we've got several different quote unquote challenges that we're dealing with as an industry as a whole, you know, I think the Jockey Club and their impact and their vision, I believe, is serving us well in the times that we face now.
Terry, thank you so much for coming on. I know it's a busy, busy couple of days for you. We appreciate you making time. Always good to talk to you.
Absolutely. Same here, Joe and John. Really great. Thank you.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Terry Finley, will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes. All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. You can learn more at westpointtb.com. Terry's been busy since we spoke with him yesterday. As we mentioned earlier, West Point purchased 8 2-year-olds in the first session of the OBS March sale, including a $560,000 colt by first-year sire Cloud Computing, a filly by Adios Charlie, who worked in 20-2, and a colt by first-year sire Collected, who Terry mentioned in the interview, from the family of Grade 1 stakes winner Arch Arch Arch. So congratulations to all the partners at West Point for coming home with all those nice 2-year-olds. Looking forward to seeing them on the track, and best of luck in the second day of the sale later today. Had a little bit of news yesterday from Churchill Downs. You know, last summer we were lamenting the end of Arlington Park and the end of the Arlington Million card, but I guess it's not the end of the Arlington Million card, since Churchill Downs announced that this summer, August 13th, they will host a special Arlington Million Day at Churchill. 4 stakes worth cumulatively $2 million, $1 million Arlington Million, the $500,000 Beverly D, $300,000 secretary at stakes and $200,000 pucker up. They're also going to run a couple of other traditional Arlington stakes at Churchill this year, including the Modesty, the Arlington Stakes, the Chicago Stakes, the American Derby, and the Hanshin Stakes. You know, on one hand, it's nice to see them keeping the tradition alive of all these stakes races that meant so much to Illinois racing and to the American landscape for real for that long. On the other hand, it seems a little bit like a slap in the face that you take their track and then you're going to take their races and run them as well. So I kind of feel both ways about this. What do you think, Bill?
I don't. I think it's terrific. Absolutely terrific. Just because we never expected this. And, you know, to think that these races like the Arlington Million would go away, you know, one of the most historic, the first $1 million race ever in this country in all the history that it's had. But it's funny, Joe, when they put out the announcement yesterday, I put something on Twitter immediately afterwards. And the responses were just, you know, overwhelming. 95% of them, people just trashing Churchill Downs. And I think there's so much animosity in the industry, even when they do something that at least I think was a really good move, people can just, you know, they can't stand them. And they come out and you know, call them greedy and all sorts of other terrible things. But, you know, you got to really think the glass is half empty to not think this is a good thing to bring these races back. Do I wish they were at Arlington Park? Of course I do. So does everybody else in the business. But once Arlington closed, that wasn't going to happen. And the alternative being either these races disappear or they get run at Churchill Downs, I'll certainly take the alternative that they get raced at Churchill Downs.
I mean, I guess. I kind of see, like I said, I see both sides of this. I could see why if you're a diehard Arlington or Illinois racing fan and you like grew up going to these races, you're not going to go to Louisville. You're not going to travel to Kentucky to go see the races that they took from your racetrack. Like, you know what I mean, Bill? Like, wouldn't that like put a sour taste in your mouth if you're an Illinois racing guy?
Yeah, I completely understand that. And by the way, there's I don't know if it's a precedent or whatnot, but the Arlington Million hasn't always been run in Arlington Park. It was run at Woodbine when they were rebuilding Arlington Park. Yeah, I mean, I think people that are Chicago racing fans, probably our colleague Alan Carrasso, are just so bitter about losing the racetrack, as well they should be. It was a terrible, terrible thing that, you know, they would, it'd be like, you know, the Cubs not playing at Wrigley Field. They're going to play at Safeco Field in Seattle or something like that, you know, something bizarre like that. But I'll stick with what I said. You know, it's better to have these races come back than not have them at all. And, you know, I don't know, I don't know what's to become of Illinois racing down the road. I mean, that's another subject that, you know, is really something we can delve into maybe when Hawthorne gets ready to run, you know, how they're going to make do with having, you know, split meets and no racing in the summer. But, you know, to me, I'm and you know who else is excited? Chad Brown, because he wins every one of those races every single year. So he's excited. If Chad's excited, I'm excited.
Yeah. And Joe, I know I said I didn't have anything to add to this, but you guys bring up a very good point. Like, how often do we see in our industry these like weekend boutique racing days or the one day and how well they do, because it's like a unique destination site. So, you know, for Churchill Downs to come in and say, we're going to have a date in August where we never race and work it out with Ellis Park, you know, through an understanding that they're going to be able to allow to have this one day meet. And it top to bottom, it sounds like it's going to be a great card. So I'm all for this kind of boutique setting situation and have it be a one-off. It seems like, you know, that of recent time, those types of dates have done very, very well for our sport.
Yeah, well, and this is like, I don't know if it's going to take the place of that. They might still do the other card, but Ellis kind of, they run a card in mid-August, which is like Kentucky Downs preview day. They run a bunch of stakes that are kind of prep races for the Kentucky Downs races coming up in September. I'm not sure, it's unclear if this is going to replace that or if this is going to go alongside it. I'm guessing it's going alongside it because they had to come with an agreement with Ellis in order to be able to run these races. But I think it might cannibalize those Kentucky Downs preview days. But yeah, you know, I agree with John. It kind of reminds me a little bit of when Keeneland ran because of COVID, when Keeneland ran in July and it was like a shortened, truncated meet. I think everybody got really excited for that. And, you know, it's the purse is $1 million. You know, we made fun of people. There would be a running joke in the past, the Arlington 500,000. Well, it's back up to $1 million. You know, Churchill can obviously afford to do that. Also, in the press release, Churchill's maiden races are going to be $120,000 through the spring meet. And additionally, there's going to be a $250 bonus awarded to trainers whose start is finished fourth through last in all non-stakes races. We talked about, you know, when we do the Kentucky bred banter about how, you know, those purses in at Keeneland and Churchill this year are going to be even more attractive than usual. So, you know, it's going to be a great meet. It's going to be a lot of money up for grabs. They also released the Derby and the Oaks Stakes schedule. So, you know, looking forward to that. But I understand if you're a Chicago person and you have a little bit of a rubbed a little bit the wrong way by this move. But yeah, I think overall, I agree with you guys that it is good that the tradition at least is going to be kept up in some way, because these were at one point marquee races on the American racing calendar. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Canterbury Park. We talked last week about what a great value it is to bet on Canterbury Park. Obviously a great value as well to stable there if you're an owner or a trainer. Canterbury Park wants everyone to know that owners sending their horses to Canterbury when their meet begins on May 18th will be rewarded, in addition to a $1,000 bonus for every starter in the month of May and a travel loan program, which we mentioned last week. Canterbury has announced yet another bonus program designed to encourage owners who raced in Illinois to race at Canterbury. So we were talking a little bit earlier about where those Illinois horsemen are going to go without Arlington Park. Canterbury is a great, very attractive option. With the closure of Arlington Park and Hawthorne Racing only through June 25th, Canterbury officials see that opportunity to attract new stables needing a summer venue. Any Canterbury starter that raced in Illinois in 2021 or 2022 but has not previously started at Canterbury will be eligible for a $1,000 bonus in their first start of the 2022 season through July 17th. So that encompasses the first 2 months of the meet. All information, full conditions, loan applications specific to these programs can be found at canterburypark.com/horsemen. So definitely very attractive place to race this summer and to bet this summer, as we talked about.
Yeah, Joe, people love to complain about the takeout, and as well they should. It's too high in the sport. So instead of just sitting around griping, do something about it. Support the tracks that give you low takeouts, and nobody has a lower takeout in the entire sport than Canterbury's Pick 5 and Pick 6, a 10% takeout. It's a bet you should be looking at every single time Canterbury races, because they're looking out for the horse player and you ought to reward them with your business.
But if us horse players didn't sit around griping, there'd be nothing for us to do when the races aren't on.
This is true.
That's our second favorite pastime. But yeah, Bill's definitely right. And I'll be betting that Pick 5 for sure when the meet opens May 18th. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. This week's XBTV workout of the week, which we're showing right now, is Latruska. Worked at Palm Meadows on Sunday, going 4 furlongs and 47.75. That was the best of 38 works at the 4 furlong distance. She was last seen, as we remember, in her 6-year-old debut, winning the Grade 3 Royal Delta Stakes in total command at Gulfstream Park. So it certainly appears like she's set for another dominating campaign this year. Be interesting to see if maybe she runs, defends her title in the Apple Blossom. We talked a little bit earlier about, you know, how good that race is shaping up. So obviously wherever she goes, she's going to be appointment viewing. Looking forward to seeing Latruska. And if you want to see all of Latruska's workouts, go to xbtv.com. Also all the 3-year-old workouts, definitely a great resource as the Derby Trail continues to heat up. We touched on this a couple of weeks ago, Bill's story about Michael Sanchez, who was suspended 60 days for betting on races, some races that he was involved in. It's kind of a little bit in the news now because there was a similar story in the NFL. Calvin Ridley, who was a receiver for the Atlanta Falcons, last year he took a leave from the team because of quote-unquote to take care of his mental well-being. It turns out during some of that time he was betting on football. He says he only bet $1,500. He defended himself, so he doesn't have a problem. The NFL did not care. They suspended him for an entire season. They said he can apply for reinstatement next February. I think that's a little bit much considering how, you know, strongly the NFL is pushing betting on the sports these days. You watch a football game, seems like 8 out of 10 commercials you'll see are for a sports book of some kind. But I get, you know, the whole integrity of the game thing. He wasn't playing at the time. But it kind of, you know, Bill brought this up, how it contrasts with horse racing, which only suspended Michael Sanchez for 60 days. And he had a much more direct impact on the horses he was betting or betting against. Bill, take it from here.
Yeah, Joe, it's always interesting to see when these things come up, how the big sports, the marquee major sports handle things versus horse racing. So whether you think Calvin Ridley deserved a year or not, this is what he gets. He gets a year suspension, and he wasn't even playing in the games. He didn't bet against his own team, anything like that. You know, he was just like anybody, just betting a couple games to have some fun, I suppose. He gets a 1-year suspension. Michael Sanchez, the jockey, who not only bet on races, he bet against, in some instances, his own horse, gets a 60-day suspension. Now, having said that, there are some extenuating circumstances with Michael Sanchez. None of the betting patterns really suggested that he was trying to stiff his horses or anything like that. And his lawyer said he just got out of control with his gambling because he was dealing with depression. But, you know, I do feel bad for the guy, and I don't think anything should happen to have ruined his career. I wouldn't say a lifetime ban, but, you know, I thought originally 60 days was horribly light. Extremely lenient. And then when you see the NFL do this, suspend a guy for a lesser offense for a year, then you start to really look at this and say, you know, maybe Michael Sanchez should be the one getting the year and Calvin Ridley should be the one, like you said, Joe, getting the 60 days because the NFL is, you know, pumping gambling like crazy. But, I have mixed feelings about that because I don't want to kick a guy when he's down. I'm sure he's going through a lot of struggles and I wish him well. But the 60-day suspension should have been more, absolutely more. And, you know, it just goes to show you that the NFL in this instance took the integrity issue a lot more seriously than horse racing did with Michael Sanchez.
Wait, you mean there's a sport out there that takes an integrity issue more seriously than horse racing?
Never.
Yeah. Could that possibly be?
And Bill Kramer said about integrity. Come on. We got the Integrity Act. Isn't that enough?
Right. Exactly. And Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, but like the 60 days, wasn't that the most that they could give Sanchez?
I'm not sure about that, John. I don't think so. No. I mean, you know, Thomas Mejia, who used a battery at Monmouth, got 10 years. I think probably using a battery is maybe a worse offense than betting against your own horses. But at the same time, they're maybe somewhat comparable. So it's interesting how they took this and gave him 10 years for what he did. Maybe there was some regulation I wasn't aware of, and then you would have had to suspend him for 60, then have the racing commission go back over it. Sometimes you get those things. But at the end of the day, they could have suspended him for a lot more than 60 days if they chose to do so.
Yeah, I mean, if the penalty period could have been extended greater than 60 days, in my estimation, it should have been in this case, because it's not even a matter of betting on racing, which you're not allowed to do as a licensed participant, whether it's an owner, you know, technically, whether it's an owner, trainer, or jockey, although I see trainers, you know, betting hand over fist.
That's the thing. I kind of want to ask that because I know that that's a rule, but it's how could they possibly enforce that, John?
No, it's not a rule. You can bet on your own horses.
Well, no, but I know, like, I'm talking about New Jersey even. Dennis Drazen, who's an attorney and a very good one, sent out letters and emails to all the owners, licensed owners, saying that you are forbidden from betting on any race, not just ones that you have, horses in. But basically, technically, if I went up to the window at Monmouth Park and bet $2 to place on a race, you know, the $5,000 claiming race before the stake race that I was running in, technically, I'm in violation of my license in New Jersey. So I understand what you're saying. I mean, who's going to police it? Nobody's going to be there.
So his transgressions occurred in, first of all, that New Jersey rule is ridiculous. These transgressions took place in Maryland and Pennsylvania. Right. To the best of my knowledge, jockeys there's no prohibitions on them either betting on their own horse or betting in races where they're not competing.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. That's very, you know, and it just goes to show you how convoluted a lot of the rules are, not only state to state, but even like, you know, when New York had that arcane rule about, you know, married couples that had to be coupled in the entries and like, you know, that's more important than, you know, of an influence than if a jockey bets on or against his own, you know, his own mount. I mean, to me, that would be tantamount to, you know, ultimate, control and conflict of interest. I understand from racing standpoint, yeah, it doesn't look good when you have a jockey who really is in control of you know, not only his own mount, but other horses in the race. As we see, you know, fill in the blank, Paco Lopez, who not only rides his own horse, but other horses in the race and can influence the outcome because of it. Those guys have to be above board and stewards of, ombudsman of racing's integrity. We have to do, you know, a better job with the jockeys. As far as the NFL, I mean, yeah, they're going to come down hard on this. And it is hypocritical that they have that they're, you know, tied in so deeply now with gambling and wagering And it used to be kind of cute when Jimmy the Greek would come on CBS and talk about, you know, this, you know, the Steelers were going to beat the Vikings. And he wouldn't say by 3.5, but they would post it on the screen that it was 3, you know, and like they couldn't even talk about it back then. And now they're so in bed with gambling that, of course, you're going to have young players, especially that are so involved with IT, that they're going to be in, you know, betting on the sport. So it's hypocritical. And, you know, a year is a long time, but I understand why they have to set the precedent for the NFL and say, no, this guy can't do it, because if they don't have a hard line on this, then it's really going to, you know, get out of control.
But I mean, like he was sitting on his couch. It wasn't like he was in the locker room at halftime on his FanDuel account. Like he was sitting on his couch. He wasn't with the team. He says it was only $1,500. I don't know that you could prove that, but if he's away from the team, he's not involved in competition of any kind. I don't get it. I mean, that's for another show to debate. And we're only bringing this up to make that comparison. And I agree with Bill. I don't think that we should ruin Michael Sanchez's life over this. But yeah, in comparison, considering he had more control and Calvin Ridley had no control, he had some control over the mounts and the horses he was betting on, even betting against. I think that 60 days was pretty light. It's kind of thing you can have no tolerance for. But I promise we'll stop beating up on Michael Sanchez now.
By the way, did you guys read? There were a couple of comments on Twitter sphere about how lenient we were when we were talking about Lascano last week. And actually, not only lenient, but that we were being hypocritical. You know, you guys rail on all of these jockeys and how terrible they are and everything like that. And then you get an obvious situation like Lascano and you don't beat him up. You know what? That's my opinion. My opinion is the guy did not try to fix a race. So I'm not being hypocritical. That's just my opinion about it. But yeah, if jockeys screw up or do, you know, do the wrong thing or bet, you know, on their own or against their own mounts, then of course I'm gonna voice my displeasure about it. But yeah, this whole nonsense about, oh, you guys are such hypocrites because you didn't see that there was, you know, potential race fixing in New York. That's
yeah, everybody's a gumshoe on racing Twitter. Everybody's the crack investigative team that has incontrovertible proof that this race was fixed. I mean, it just, that's one of the things that I don't like about racing Twitter is it's so black and white. You know, if you don't agree with me, you're an asshole. And if you can't see this, you're a hypocrite. Like there's, you know, go complain to the Naira stewards. Like they didn't suspend him or fine him or anything. Like I hate these scenarios where there is room for debate, where people want to make no room for debate, because I thought that, you know, especially when we were talking last week about the Paco Lopez thing and then about the Lescano thing, the Paco Lopez thing was way worse than what Jose Lescano did. Now, if it happens again, Jose Lescano does something like that again, then maybe you can talk about, you know, something a little fishy going on. But there was absolutely no evidence that he was trying to fix that race. But you don't need any evidence anymore. You just yell loud enough and, you know, you're the authority on that event.
Well, luckily, we can yell the loudest and the broadest because we have this show. So to hell with you.
There you go.
I can see my bars going up right now into the red. I'm yelling very, very loud. Loud noises. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Legacy Bloodstock sales grads have already made it to the winner's circle 47 times in 2022, including new graded stakes winner Temple, who won the Mac Jarman about a week or two ago. And last year, Legacy sold 87% of their yearlings, offered great clearance rate, including the highest priced yearlings by four different sires in 2021. I'm sure they'll be involved in the yearling sales coming up later this summer as well. So we'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse, every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
So this week's Remy Bullock cartoon. We brought that up last week. Love Remy's cartoons. Love it every week in the TDN. And now in the TDN Writers Room, you can see them as well. This week's cartoon is very, very cute and very funny. I love it. So the horse is running at the Cheltenham Festival, which is this week. Saying, what, this again? Because I always feel like they got to get tired of jumping all over those damn fences, especially coming down this stretch. It's like, you're really asking a lot of me. You know, I'm just thoroughbred. But, you know, love Remy, love that cartoon. And shout out to Cheltenham, everybody that's at Cheltenham, everybody that's betting it this week. It started yesterday, was the first day on Tuesday, and it goes through this Friday, March 18th. So obviously very tradition-heavy, very exciting race meet little festival. So we're enjoying that, looking forward to that. And then a couple months away from Royal Ascot as well. So we'll keep our eyes across the pond for those boutique meets. We know John loves them. John loves the boutique meet, as he said earlier in the show. So, and I hope you're betting a little bit on the jumpers this week. All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. Reminder that the Keeneland Spring Meet starts April 8th, and the Keeneland Horses of Racing Age sale is April 29th, which is also the last day of the Spring Meet. Get involved on the races at KeenelandSelect.com. And entries for the Horses of Racing Age sale are now open. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Terry Finley, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you all so much for watching. Enjoy the tournament. See you next week.